This is the Reason Podcast, and I'm your host, Nick Gillespie. Please subscribe to us at iTunes, Google Play Music, Reason.com, or anywhere you get your podcast on. And while you're there, rate and review us. Let us know how you're doing. Today, I am at Freedom Fest, the world's largest annual gathering of libertarians and free marketers, held every July in Las Vegas. We're at the Paris Hotel this time at Freedom Fest. And sitting across the table from me is George Gilder, a tech visionary who has a long record of figuring out what's coming next and mostly getting it right. We're going to talk about that. And he's got a new book out called Life After Google, The Fall of Big Data and the Rise of the Blockchain Economy. George, thanks for talking.
Great to be here.
Okay, so give me the elevator pitch of Life After Google.
Well, that Google is the triumphant company of this era. But it's more than merely a company supplying a broad range of digital products, converting the whole world into a database, from traffic on streets to the map of the globe and all the books.
Every email that anybody has ever written, all of this kind of stuff. And it's, but you don't like it partly because it's all in one place, or it's all one company.
It's all one company. It's and it escapes the need for security largely by giving all its products away. So it thus escapes the most critical responsibility for any information producer, and that is to guarantee the security and the property of its users.
But what if the users don't care? And I say this as somebody, I'm on Google, I use Google products tremendously, all of that kind of stuff. And I could go to, I could use email services, I could use phone services that are encrypted, end-to-end encrypted. And I'm just saying, like, I don't care either.
I use so Google. I say this, Google is the dominant company of this era. Mm-hmm. It's more than the dominant company. It's the dominant source of public philosophy of this era. And it has a vision of both the economy and the human mind that I think is deeply flawed,
and
ultimately dooms its
agenda. So it's not that the products right now aren't good and important and incredibly useful, but that
miraculously good. Yeah. 42 megahertz search engine is awesome.
I was talking with people. I can remember when MapQuest came out, you know, and you could get turn by turn directions and print out on your inkjet printer, and it would take 40 minutes to print out a map to go 20 minutes in a car. But that was spectacular. And now Google Navigator and Google Maps, it's like, I don't know how I got anywhere before that. But what you're saying is that this era, and what would be a previous company that played the role of Google? But I mean, that
IBM.
Yeah, perfect.
IBM,
right? IBM's still around, itty bitty minds. It's better manually, whatever. Yeah. It just doesn't matter.
And
you're looking at the world after Google stops mattering.
That's right.
And one of your main cases is that because it is all one company and all centralized. Is that correct?
Yeah.
So
it's creating a walled garden of the internet controlled essentially by two nerds in Silicon Valley. And this model of achieving commerce on the internet by homogenizing a walled garden doesn't replicate. I mean, we now have, Google can have a walled garden and Apple can have a walled garden as Jobs envisaged, and if Zuckerberg can have his Facebook garden, you know, why can't the communist Chinese rulers have their walled garden?
Aren't they
their internet?
To?
Yes. Yeah. And the Iranian mullahs. In the end, the whole internet breaks into fragile fiefdoms and no longer functions.
So this is, you know, it's funny. I was just bitching with my kids. I have a couple of Apple products, but mostly I use Android products and Microsoft, or, you know, a Windows 10 program. And I was saying, you know, Amazon which is pretty good, but like they screw you on the Kindle, like where they make it hard to actually, you don't have the full Google Play, the Android app store. Apple makes it impossible, essentially, to use Amazon products. Or, you know, they make it as difficult as possible. Yeah. Everybody's trying to screw each other over.
And their security doesn't interoperate. So so it results in constant combinatorial explosions of contrary security procedures. And it ends up filling the internet with malware and advertising hustles that are actually minuses, value subtracted advertising much of the time, pop-ups and pop-unders. And it's just an architecture at the end of the line.
So is this architecture, and I'm thinking, because what I want to talk with you about is, you know, both Life After Google, but your book Life After Television, which, what was that, 1986?
1990.
Yeah. And, you know, that, I mean, a lot of these themes sound similar. And in that book, you made a distinction between what you called hierarchies and heterarchies. Are you saying that what we're living in now is in a world of increasing hierarchies? After there was a Wild West period on the, online, and now suddenly, you know, people are staking their territory and they're saying, hey, if you want to use Amazon stuff, go ahead. I mean, knock yourself out, but don't we're not going to make it easy for you to walk across the street and get a soda from from Apple. So that's what's happening.
And because the security is porous, millions of passwords and usernames flow across the network all the time and are captured constantly by hackers. It's a porous cloud. And in a porous cloud, all the money and power rises to the top. And it creates a crisis of equality and a crisis of security and a crisis of property rights on the net.
So then what happens in Life After Television? I believe I'm remembering correctly. I mean, one of the things you talked about was, you know, the broadcast model in that sense, you know, was kind of inherently totalitarian. In a lot of ways, you sounded like a Frankfurt School cultural critic. Broadcasting, it was these people literally at the top beaming out signals, and you had to, if you wanted what they were selling or giving away, you had to be there, you had to stand at attention when they wanted, and you us down, not in the cloud but on the ground, we had to sit around and wait and do their bidding. So something similar here is
happening. It's a recurrence of that model. And very good point, by the way. It's not quite in the book as lucidly as that.
Okay, so we know what happened to the broadcast model or an IBM model. And, you know, and you can see it in places like Microsoft, where Microsoft, in a lot of ways, is still dealing with many of its customers and vendors as if it's 1999 or 1998, not 2018. And they're kind of like, hey, look, you know what? You can't, they assume people can't go anywhere else. They act poorly. We know why kind of television networks, broadcasting models broke down because of new technology, because the customers, the viewers got pissed off. And they're like, I'm going to go make my own culture. I'm going to develop something else. The first, what you kind of charmingly called telecomputers, but, you know, networked computers and the internet.
Telecomputers.
Yeah. So what is going to happen to, you know, what is the crisis point and the transition point for Life After Google?
Security. Just the absurd nervous breakdown that Silicon Valley is having over security, which they take out on the customers. Their frustration with their inability to protect data across the net, they explicitly blame the customers. Humans just aren't smart enough to deal with their wonder.
Like we don't want to do two-step authentication, and so we get hacked, and it's our
Yeah, that's right.
How does this play out? Talk about in two ways. One is the recent Facebook hearings, where which were pushed by the idea that Facebook actors on Facebook were acting in bad faith. Cambridge Analytica and the people who kind of fed them information. So suddenly you have Mark Zuckerberg, and it's very redolent of robber baron in the late 19th or early 20th century being called to Congress and called to account, and he says, I'm sorry, I'm going to do better. Is that the kind of security risk where people feel like their information is being taken from them or used against them?
This reaction is kind of inevitable in a system where the data is all controlled from the top. And that's what we've built. We've built a system based on top-down control of data and free goods, so that the customers have no real claims on the suppliers, because after all, the goods are free.
Yeah.
Big companies are sort of relieved of a lot of the security challenges that any real business has to face. If their goods are free, nobody really wants to steal them. So they thus are relieved of having to create a chain of responsibility.
Because even antivirus programs are free now. Everything is free, but you...
They're free and in effect...
So, but I don't think you haven't answered to my satisfaction, and I'm being purposefully dense here, but who cares? When Facebook, when I learned about the Cambridge Analytica scandal, I went, and the idea that, I might be targeted with ads that I cannot even remember the last time I looked at a Facebook ad, or much less clicked or bought anything. I wasn't outraged. I'm nervous because I know that the government, and they did it right on cue. They said, okay, we're going to regulate you. And Mark Zuckerberg said, I do want you to know that, if you regulate me, that'll be good for me, because I'm going to write the regulations with you, and we're going to, the next Facebook is going to have a tougher.
I think he's right. If he said that, that's the smartest thing he said at this hearing.
He said exactly that. And a couple of congressmen, even to their credit, said that, but they were like, but we need to do this. But what I'm not seeing is, I don't care about my...
You'll care about the general degeneration of internet services. And you should care about the collapse of IPOs that is associated with this top-down model. There's 90% drop in IPOs. They're now... several times more IPOs in communist China than in the United States.
Because people realize, we went through this.
And there's 50% drop in the number of public companies.
Right.
It's a general agglomeration of the economy that no longer functions well, particularly for entrepreneurial creativity, which is a source of all growth and progress.
So it's kind of like in the first wave of the tech bubble, or of internet companies. Okay, you give stuff away for free on the idea that you're going to make it up later. You'll figure out how to monetize it later. Here we are 20 years later, and we're still giving it away for free. But everybody knows you're not going to be able to monetize it. Google makes its money by selling ads people increasingly don't pay attention
to. But there's a whole new movement across the whole world economy based on the new cryptographic innovations, the blockchain and hash graphs and all these technologies that make it possible for a block stack, where everything doesn't flow to the top.
So talk about that, because it is, the subtitle of the book is The Fall of Big Data. So we get that Amazon, Facebook, Google, Twitter even. I mean, they know tons of your habits, right? They can track you anywhere. But that's the fall. That's going away, you say, and it's the rise of the blockchain economy.
Yeah.
Let's talk about that. So
this is a new security architecture for the internet, and it replaces the current architecture, which doesn't work, and it provides a new basis for transactions across the internet. You no longer have to confine transactions to some walled garden and with reference to outside third parties. Instead, transactions can become intrinsic to the internet itself, and these intrinsic transactions retain the power for the content producers. They redistribute power around the internet.
Part of what happens with the blockchain, the underlying technology of Bitcoin and Ether or Ethereum and things like that, Blockstack, is that every user, you know, basically has, you know, there's a clear, transparent public record of every transaction.
Yeah.
So it's hard. You can't hide stuff. You can't hide money. There are no, oh, it's going to take 3 weeks for the payment to get there, so I'm going to take it and put it in an interest-bearing account and kind of shave a little bit off for myself. But is that scalable? First off, just as a technical matter?
Well, it's already, imagine, Ethereum is a flawed system platform, like Bitcoin is a flawed platform. There are many thousands of flawed platforms in the cryptographic world, but all kinds of innovations are emerging. All of these, Ethereum, for all its limitations, proved to be the answer for the IPO crisis. The SEC managed to stop IPOs, essentially. Sarbanes-Oxley.
So how does Ethereum work around that?
Well, Ethereum launched the initial crypto offering, the ICO, the initial coin offering, whatever you want to call it, the initial Cayman offering.
Right.
Raised more money in months than the IPO market was raising.
With ICOs, though, or rather with coins, I mean, a lot of that stuff is back to a walled garden where it's like, you know, use our tokens. It's like going to an arcade and
for
instead of using quarters, you know, like, oh, you got to use the, you know, the Chuck E. Cheese token. That seems like a nightmare.
All this is effervescence of creativity. All sorts of experiments are being conducted across the cryptographic realm, these tokens, utility tokens, have very specific purposes. They, on the other hand, there are new technologies to convert among them and to merge them into a larger scheme. A new economy is emerging.
Being born. Okay.
And it's being born.
How will this
and
get around
and,
China?
And it's $10 billion was raised for a couple thousand of these companies. 46% of them went broke. But out of this will be emerge a whole series of new solutions security across the internet.
Yeah. So, how does this? You know, you were talking about walled gardens, and it's fascinating that in a lot of ways, America Online, you know, rest its soul, had an early walled garden that was actually pretty good. People always make fun of AOL, but they replicated a lot of Usenet groups. They had communities. They had live events. And then, because of Earthlink and a bunch of other things, companies, they had to let their people go to the internet. And then once you're gone, you don't come back. But we're seeing a return to walled gardens. And you talked about, I mean, Facebook explicitly, their vision is to keep people on Facebook and to have you do everything on Facebook. One of my questions is, China is creating its own walled garden, right? And it may not be as nice a garden as Facebook, but how does blockchain...
Might be nicer.
Yeah, well, this that, is... I want to ask you in a question.
This whole idea that China can't innovate is very...
Do you think it's racist, ultimately? Or is it blinded by
because
history?
They are a communist regime, and they have very adversarial politics. Yeah. But their economic policies are in many ways much better than ours. More entrepreneurship, more IPOs, increasing amounts of venture capital, competitive with the United States. The Chinese government has just banned ICOs for at least some phase of their development.
So here's a question. I mean, I'll jump to this question, then I want to come back to blockchain. But is it possible... You know, that in 5 years, we'll be saying, you know what, China, maybe it's a walled garden, maybe it's not, but that's actually where the innovation is going to come from. Because when you have people like Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton or Bernie Sanders who don't use Uber, who don't know what Uber is, who don't use smartphones, don't use email, you know, they're not going to be the people they're not going to help us move into the future. They're going to throw up every stupid policy they can, right?
Well,
to keep things the way they are.
The SEC is better than the Chinese financial regulator at the moment. Yeah. I mean, the SEC is quite positive okay. toward ICOs.
So how does blockchain work through? I mean, I think a lot of people, and certainly a lot of people listening to this podcast, can understand how in a relatively free society or a free economy, a free market, blockchain pulls, you know, it pulls power out of few hands and distributes it around a system. The whole idea is that it's public knowledge. It's a ledger system that constantly is telling everybody where everything is. How does that get into a place like China? How does it get into a place like Russia?
Well,
how does it get
into? It came from China. The key insight in the whole development of blockchain was probably Bitmain. You know, a bunch of Chinese teenagers who decided that, who saw that Bitcoin was going to be huge and that the first person who developed a mining ASIC would prosper. And Bitmain made $4 billion of profits last year, was the most profitable semiconductor company in the world. Now it's diversifying into AI chips, and it's what Silicon Valley used to do. And I've been a chip man all my life, and I'm more impressed with Bitmain than I am with a lot of companies that are doing ingenious new applications for social exchange.
What's wrong with Silicon Valley now? Is it a cultural problem in the sense Silicon Valley has had a good run of, you know, decades of being not just profitable, but the kind of dominant business site in America? Are they just kind of fat and lazy in a way that you can never get
out of? Well, they're under assault by government.
Okay, so you think it's less about the people there and it's more about the regulatory structure.
And the philosophy that Silicon Valley perhaps protectively adopts. I mean, they adopt global warming catastrophism. If you really regard every emission of CO2 as somehow poisonous pollution, you can't really have an industrial economy. So that's why industry moves to China. It's not because of some failure of America beyond its ideology. It's or some conspiracy by the Chinese government.
It's not industrial planning on the part of China. It's
anti-industrial planning on the part of the United States.
Let's go back to life after.
They're also trying to break down the Silicon Valley meritocracy. Diversity officers have to be installed in every Silicon Valley company to make sure that the pattern of employees is not the best engineers, but a pathetic pattern that corresponds to various verticals.
I mean, you're telling me that, based on his public memo, I don't know if James Damore was a good computer scientist, but I know he's not a particularly convincing essayist. So
James Damore is, not a great mind.
Right.
But he was pointing this to a distortion of employment policy that's going to be very destructive to these big, obvious, exposed agglomerations of power like Google, Facebook, Amazon. They can all be brought down by the administrative state if it really focuses on them and tries to control their employment policies, which are really critical to the future.
But you would also agree that to the extent that Microsoft, which is still a vastly big, profitable, and actually a forward-looking company finally after a long time in the wilderness, but they didn't drop off the face of the map because of government regulation. It was a failure of vision.
It didn't help.
Yeah. Okay. It's like they were going to be left out of the internet anyway, right?
Yeah.
Let me go back to life after television, because again, I think
I'm not for antitrust against all these.
Oh, companies. Of course, yeah. Antitrust against Microsoft, and I can remember at one point. It must have been like half a dozen or a dozen CEOs from roughly competing companies went to the Senate and said, you really need to do something about Microsoft. And it's like, the robber barons teaming up against, the one guy who was getting it right. It's like history repeating itself. But life after television, Again, which for me, what was fascinating about it and truly visionary was the idea that all of these centralized powers and these silos, and it's, you know, ABC, CBS, NBC, they're losing their power. And power is leaching out from the top of the pyramid to the bottom to a point where there are no more pyramids. There's only a lot of little one-story ranch houses where people are doing everything they want and cooking up weird stuff in their garages. What about that book would you say that you got wrong? Like, when you look back at it, what was the big failing of the book? Or is there one?
Well, you know, I think Google actually fulfilled it to the greater extent than anybody else. They made advertising discreet, rational, oriented toward the users. That's why I think Google is the triumphant success. It really fulfilled life after television. So I think I sort of got it right there.
Yeah.
I suppose I underestimated the extent to which the telcos would be subdued into government utilities, and that retarded the expansion of actual internet hardware.
Although, do you feel that way now? Do you feel like government policy and regulatory policy?
Well, government policy is, AT&T bought the Huffington, Verizon bought the Huffington Post.
Right.
AT&T is buying Time Warner. I mean, if the government tells you don't actually lay fiber all over the world, do software. Software eats everything. Become a content source. I mean, do you really want your content from AT&T and Verizon? I mean, it's bizarre. It's like Sarnoff and these old TV people thinking that they could control the NBC Symphony Orchestra.
I'm hearing the ghost of Marshall McLuhan whispering in my head, and that the medium is the message, and that what you're saying is that in the past, and it was David Sarnoff at RCA and then NBC, he could make a lot of money selling radios, and he's like, oh well, I can do that, and I should also supply the content, and the same thing with TVs. You run out of space after a while, or you're just
pretty
not very
quick.
Good at
yeah.
it. And that's happened. That's happening again now.
Yeah. And Google is changing with its AI policy from being a search engine to be a solutions engine, an answer man. And this is essentially Google moving like Sarnoff into the world of content. And I think that we're not going to be satisfied with one source of all our answers across the internet.
And so, I mean, in a way, and again, going back to life after television, we don't need, part of it is that once we have the right infrastructure in place, we don't need a single content creator because we'll create our own content.
That's right.
We'll stitch together. I want to ask you, it's fascinating to me because on the tech side, you are absolutely one of the most relentless visionaries in whether life after television and telecosm and microcosm and all of your books, you keep moving into the next space. And, you know, maybe some things you get wrong, most things you get right, and you're moving in the right direction. How does that square with your earlier work? And I'm thinking of books like Visible Man, Sexual Suicide. Yeah. That are so focused on specific kind of conservative, I think it's safe to say socially conservative values and analyses of human interaction, which seem so at odds with, because Sexual Suicide, and if I'm remembering the argument correctly, part of it is that men and women are biologically different. We have roles that evolve and that are relatively fixed, and that we play with those roles, like we open them up or discard them at our peril. It's very much in the body. It's very much it's in cells. It's in the things we do. And then on the other hand, you have this incredible liberation where you are moving, and now Bitcoin or blockchain allows us to leave this world behind, and we're living in pure potential, almost, and we're disembodied. How do you square these types
of things? Well, I do think that reproduction is a vital human function. If we've botched that, we aren't going to have any future.
Right.
So I really do think that maintaining the biological, the sexual constitution, as I called it, in sexual suicide is important for procreation, for having new generations of human beings.
But we're doing okay. I mean, population growth is going to peak in another 50 years, and then it'll start to decline.
But, it depends on the figures, but there's a lot of, you know, U.S. is no longer reproducing its population. Europe is no longer.
Japan, more advanced societies
are all way sub
replacement
level, and I think this is a real threat to advanced societies. This can bring them down, even in the face of tremendous technological advances.
So part of that is because, I mean, but, you know, and I'm thinking of a book that came out a few years ago called What to Expect When No One's Expecting by Jonathan Lass, the conservative writer at the Weekly Standard. And he basically said, you know, what happens is that as modernity takes place, women have more autonomy, women have more years of education, they have more options. You know, they have fewer kids. They have kids later and they have fewer kids. And men insist on fewer kids as well, or they go along with that. So how, you know, again, and part of what you're talking
but
about.
But we don't, like, but, the, okay. but the, they also demand that old people all be supplied with a tremendous array of goods and services produced by an ever diminishing cohort of
that's what robots are for, right?
I believe that robots will create more jobs. There's zero evidence. This is one of the completely obtuse views of Silicon Valley, that somehow AI and robotics will destroy jobs. There's no evidence whatsoever.
But the more
technologies deployed, the more jobs are created, the better jobs are created, the safer jobs, the more productive jobs.
Silicon Valley
should stop trying to obsolete human minds and make them productive again.
It's also true, the more robots you create, maybe the less kids you're going to have, because people will have sex robots, or people will be doing non-reproductive.
That's why I think the complete sort of a rejection of religion in Silicon Valley is actually a fatal flaw. Advanced societies become incapable of reproducing themselves except through robots, the future will be relinquished to the jihad or to societies that retain their sexual constitutions more successfully.
But, I mean, Islamic countries, are they busting at the seams with new babies? I mean,
some of them are.
Yeah, but everybody who can gets the fuck out as soon as they can, because nobody, I mean, you know, people in Iran don't want to live under a theocracy anymore.
We'll see.
Yeah.
But some societies will combine procreative success with technological advance, and those societies will do better than ones that imagine that human beings can be reduced to a guaranteed annual income while the industrial leaders fly off into outer space on missiles and procreate their technologies through an ever livelier universe.
Now you're saying that, I mean, like it's a bad thing.
Well, I don't know. I don't think it's a bad thing that they go into outer space. I think it's a bad thing that they have so little imagination about the potential of the human mind that they actually think their machines can supplant it. Information theory showed that that's impossible. Machines are deterministic of functions. That's how they're defined. And as Shannon showed, information is surprise. It's unexpected results. Surprises in machines are bad. You want machines, including computing machines, are necessarily dependent on programmers. Oracles, Alan Turing called them. And he said, what's this oracle that's going to program the machine? All I can tell you is that ultimately it can't be a machine. Okay. It has to be creative. And the human mind is still the only creative machine. And AI is not, they try to talk by the issue of consciousness. They say consciousness is emergent or secondary. But consciousness isn't. It's the source of thought rather than an effect of thought.
So are you confident or at least hopeful that somebody will come up with a way to maintain this vast technological growth, almost, you know, reaching a kind of singularity level of exponential growth and increase and whatnot, and coming up with a way where we still want to have more kids than the family we grew up.
Yeah. Well, if we're human beings, we discover that the greatest gratifications of human life come from our children. Our children remember
us. Do you
us.
Have children?
I have four children.
Okay, because I got to tell you right now, when I think about my kids, I'm not sure gratification is the first self-gratification for me.
There are bad moments, but not many. And yeah. And that it's children that really connect men to the future. The man's link to the future passes through the womb of a woman.
So
and
you,
that is
wow.
That's a crucial fact of life.
So
that,
do you
that
think,
hasn't been transcended yet through artificial intelligence?
And, I mean, do you think that that's part of the problem? I mean, in Silicon Valley, that we have a lot of kind of boy men who are not interested in children, or they'll say, "My company is my child," and they pair. I mean, that's an issue.
Yeah. Well, if they can motivate themselves to keep working for a lifetime with rather than diddling themselves with sex robots or whatever, you know, they can still have gratifying lives. But in general, I do not have a good feeling about the future of a society that without children, which imagines that manufacturing robots will offer similar gratifications.
Well, and it's true. I don't know, is there an example of a country or a broad economy that has fewer people that continues to expand? I mean, it's hard to
point to. Well, Japan is scarcely expanding.
Yeah, I mean, they're a kind of oracle of a future that I don't think even Japan doesn't want. I mean, it's... How do you talk about, I mean, you believe, despite believing in many traditional kind of gender roles or gender splits, you believe in full political equality across the genders, right?
Sure.
Yeah. So how do you convince women that the future passes through their womb?
Well, if they, you know, what we have is a university system that's captured the crucial commanding heights of government and is imposing a kind of unisex regime across the society. They literally are. You know, women want indoor work with no heavy lifting, and they get it. And now they're getting actual preferences all across the economy, while at the same time, issuing a steady stream of protests against the existing sexual relationships. And I think this is not a sustainable model, that the feminist solution, which is really has to be imposed by government, is hostile to liberty and hostile to human creativity, hostile to a future of growth and prosperity.
You're enough of a skeptic of government programs, though. Also, I take it you don't believe in natalist policies, that government should be,
There's so many anti-natalist policies now that, you know, there's the few natalist policies like the earned income credit is kind of, or it's the first effort.
No, and that child exemption, I mean, which, you know, just got increased. Countries like
France. It got increased to a level about a quarter or something what it was in 1955.
Do you think... Do you think those policies generally are effective?
No, they generally, overall, you know, it depends on the whole culture. Some policy, if you combine it with abortion as birth control, for example, you'll probably not succeed in reproducing the society.
I'm thinking I was born in 1963, and my birth announcement, which I discovered a few years ago, it was a little baby with a diaper that was stamped with another tax deduction. But I'm pretty sure my parents didn't have three kids as opposed to two or four because of taxes.
Yeah. In any individual case, but, you know, incrementally across the whole society, the economic influences converge and produce different outcomes.
And is this also a place where, I mean, you've got to be kind of interested in China in that sense, after a brutal non-natalist policy, you know, a one-child policy, which has been lifted, people were routing around that because it didn't suit what they wanted.
They sure did.
So it's
it was a catastrophic communist mistake. It was one of their...
True. I mean, well, I assume you believe in heaven and hell, so the architects of that policy will be suffering for a long time to come.
Whatever. This is not chiefly a religious issue, and for my part.
Just to close out, though, can I ask, I mean, because, and again, I find one of the things that I find fascinating about your work is both its predictive quality, but then holding in balance these, you know, kind of, you know, for me, old school ideas and then this, you know, technological marvel. And my question for you is, when you said, like, you know, religion, like, how do you maintain religion? And if I'm not mistaken, you were raised, or you're some kind of, like, high Anglican, or...
I mean, it's... Or you... My mother is a devout Christian. Okay. My stepfather wasn't particularly... You know, I lived in a very secular world in my youth.
But... I mean, and when you talk about religion, you're not talking about a one single revealed truth, but rather a kind of attitude towards
a recognition that the universe is based on information. It's creative, and can't be captured in some hermetic mathematical formula. I think Kurt Gödel demonstrated that mathematics cannot be a complete system, that it's necessarily based on creative propositions beyond the mathematical scheme.
So,
and this is true of all logical schemes, including computers. And it tells me that just as human beings are creative, they're part of a universe that's also creative.
Without going fully down to a kind of intelligent design theory, but I think you may have hit on a formulation that would be very appealing to a lot of people creating the technology that's empowering this shift from hierarchies to heterarchies, to a kind of flattening of blockchain.
Right.
Well, we're going to leave it there. We have been talking with George Gilder, the author most recently of Life After Google, The Fall of Big Data and the Rise of the Blockchain Economy. We're speaking to him at Freedom Fest, the annual event, the world's largest gathering of libertarians in the thousands now, which is a good sign for those of us who are libertarian. George, I want to thank you for talking.
Well, thank you, as always.
This has been the Reason Podcast. I'm your host, Nick Gillespie. Please subscribe to us at iTunes, at Google Play Music, at Reason.com, or wherever you get your podcast on. And when you're there, rate and review us. Let us know how we're doing. Thanks for listening.